From Brennan to the Boca Chiel, from Lummi to La Push, and from the lordly Sawduck to lovely Duckabush. From Samish to Sammamish, Suquamish to Quilicene, the climate is so friendly, it's a land that's evergreen.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Evergreen State podcast. I'm your host, John C., and thank you for joining me today for episode 110, An Early History of Husky Football. The Seattle of 1889 was not a modern city with Starbucks, Microsoft white-collar executives, and enormous sports arenas. What it did have were numerous saloons, brothels, lumber mills, hardware stores, and horse-drawn carriages churning through the male-dominated town's puddle-filled streets. On the 6th of June, when a terrible fire devoured the majority of the city, people found comfort in the fact that the most notable structure was still standing. The Territorial University was housed in a white colonial-style structure in the heart of Seattle. Seattle residents didn't require any further inspiration to rebuild because of an impending milestone. Washington was admitted as the 42nd state of the Union on the 11th of November 1889. Thus, the Territorial University changed its name to the University of Washington. On Thanksgiving Day of 1889, the University of Washington held its first ever football game amid the woods. Just east of downtown, near Jefferson Street Park, was where the game took place. UW was defeated 20-0 by an Eastern College alumni team in a game that was more akin to rugby than modern football. Eastern College was the generic name of the team made up of players from various Ivy League schools. Until that day, four of Washington's 11 players had never even played football before. By the 1890s, it had been determined that the gritty aspects of downtown Seattle were unsuitable for a prominent university setting. 5 miles away, in a forested area near the stunning shores of Lake Washington, vast property was attained. An argument over school colors erupted one day in an English lesson as part of an effort to build school traditions. When a teacher by the name of Louis Frazier read aloud from Lord Byron's Destruction of Sennacherib, the situation was quickly resolved. The poem contained these apt lines: "The Assyrian came down like a wolf on the fold, and his cohorts were gleaming in purple and gold." By competing against Washington Agricultural College, now known as Washington State University, on the 22nd of November 1900, Washington officially began the new century. The 5-5 draw resulted in the beginning of a new rivalry that would later come to be known as the Apple Cup. Seattleites came together on the 20th of November 1903 thanks to Washington football like never before. 5,000 rowdy supporters cheered on Washington against Nevada throughout the game at the former Denny Field, located on the northwest corner of the campus near 45th Street. Local supporters overpowered a small group of Nevada fans. Washington was crowned the West Coast champion after their 2-0 victory. After they left the park, tens of thousands of people marched through the city streets while pounding on drums, drinking alcohol, and singing into the night. Seattle wasn't big enough to hold Washington supporters Friday night, and it never will be, according to the Seattle Times. Seattle's population increased as a result of the steady influx of newcomers. Seattle was envisioned by civic leaders as a model city for the West Coast of America. They came to the conclusion that a dominant football team could boost the city's standing on the national stage. Soon after, Washington bravely hired Gilmore Dobie as a desired coach at the astounding sum of $3,000 annually. Dobie never suffered a defeat throughout his 9 seasons at Washington. He amassed a stunning 58-0-3 record, which included a 39-game winning streak and was a part of a run of 63 games without suffering a loss. The latter still holds the NCAA record. Only 12 touchdowns were allowed by Washington throughout those same 9 seasons. Dobie was also stern, commanding, and scary. No grin, no handshakes, no pats on the back, nothing but a pair of cold eyes looking out of a dark face that was partially disguised by a slouch hat drawn loosely over a head of moose black hair, recalled a former player. The university's administration suspended a player during the 1916 campaign due to alleged exam irregularities. Dobie backed the Washington players who made a strike threat. Henry Suzzolo, the subject of recent episode 109 and the incoming UW president, was enraged by this. Days were spent spreading rumors that Suzzolo had sparked the strike at Dobie's request. Seattle's Chamber of Commerce Secretary C.B. Yandell declared, "We require Dobie in Washington. Seattle and the state would suffer if he were to leave." Suzzolo ended his statement with the following words: "Character development is the university's main goal. On the football field, Mr. Dobie did not execute his fair part of this duty. We thus do not want him to come back the following year." Many Washington supporters were devastated by this news because they had just witnessed 9 straight seasons in which their team went undefeated. Doby responded to his termination by saying that he had carried out his duties fully. Dr. Suzzolo is mistaken when he claims that I behaved any differently. A former player came forward more than 30 years later and acknowledged that he, not Doby, was the one who had provoked the disobedience. The College Football Hall of Fame includes Doby amongst its notable ranks. Washington suffered 9 losses in games over the next 4 years after Doby was fired. Everyone connected with the program was horrified by this turn of events. It was determined that changes were required. Husky Stadium, a 30,000-seat bowl excavated from the ground by water pressure, was constructed in just 8 months. The stadium opened on the 17th of November 1920, following the groundbreaking on the 17th of May 1920. The team's moniker changed from Sun Dodgers to Vikings to Huskies in the course of just 15 months. Enoch Begshaw, a well-known high school coach, was selected as Washington's next head coach. Begshaw, who went by the moniker Beggy, was a gruff and rule-following sort. Washington's football success during the Roaring Twenties was largely a reflection of the general economic expansion in America. George Wilson was a recruit who followed Beggy to Washington and went on to become a legend. Back in April of 2021, episode 39 focused on this UW football legend. Go check it out after this episode if you'd like to learn more. It's a fascinating story. The 1923 team played USC for the first time and finished with a 10-1-1 record. The school's first game to be broadcast on radio was also the first sellout in the history of Husky Stadium. The Trojans lost to UW 22-0. Washington tied Navy 14-14 to finish the season in its first Rose Bowl. The 1925 Huskies were a team to remember, going 10-1-1 once more while scoring 480 points to lead the country. They defeated Willamette 108-0 to start things off. Washington tied the legendary Cornhuskers 6-6 during their maiden journey east of the Rockies, where they arrived by rail. They suffered a devastating 20-19 loss to Alabama in the Rose Bowl to cap both their campaign and Wilson's career. Wilson's Rose Bowl performance earned him high praise from Damon Runyon of New York, who gave boxer James J. Braddock the moniker the Cinderella Man. He stated, "He is one of the finest players of this or any other time, a one-man football team." For many years following, critics argued that the Washington-Alabama game was the most thrilling Rose Bowl game ever played. In 1929, at the same time that America entered the Great Depression, Beggy's tenure in Washington came to an end. Despite the decade's great success, Begshaw's incapacity to attract and network with supporters and graduates led to an increase in boosters' complaints. In November of 1929, Beggy was fired after a gruesome loss to the awful Chicago club coached by Amos Alonzo Stagg. His record while at the University of Washington overall was 63-22-6. Washington appointed the corrosive James Phelan as its head coach as the nation battled through quite a difficult economic period. A statement Phelan made to a reporter in the middle of the 1930s reads, "I'd rather outsmart those bastards on the higher campus than knock off Oregon State," pretty much sums up his character the best. Throughout Phelan's 12 years at Washington, the squad only made it to one Rose Bowl, where they were defeated 21-0 by Pittsburgh. The accomplishment of defeating USC 5 years in a row and 7 times out of 8 was the era's pinnacle. Dr. Alfred Strauss, a prominent UW alum, attracted a number of outstanding players from Chicago. They were known as the Strauss Boys, and for 20 years, about 50 of them took the train to Seattle. Ray Frankowski, Rudy Mucha, Paul Schwegler from Raymond, Washington, and others were recognized as All-Americans in 1931. Afterwards, Schwegler enjoyed a modest level of success as an actor in Hollywood. Phelan was abruptly let go by the UW in late December of 1941, despite having a 65-37-8 record. Fans and past players alike voiced their disapproval of the announcement, with Phelan himself referring to it as another Pearl Harbor deal. It was later discovered that administrators were highly concerned about Phelan's drinking habits. Ralph Pest Welch was appointed as the next head football coach at UW at the same time as the U.S.'s entry into World War II. Everyone liked Welch, but during the 6 years he oversaw the football program at Washington, very little happened. 1943 was the only notable season. Wartime limitations had an impact on the Pacific Coast Conference's scheduling, making it an odd season overall. Following 3 games against local military teams, the Huskies played Whitman. The Northern and Southern League champions faced off in that year's Rose Bowl. This is how, on the 1st of January 1944, Washington 4-0 and USC 7-2 met in Pasadena. By the time of the Rose Bowl, many of Washington's star players were engaged in combat in Europe. U.S. troops all around the world were listening to a radio broadcast of the Rose Bowl for the first time. Even though the game in Italy started at 1 in the morning, NBC reported that General Eisenhower authorized everyone who wasn't on the firing line permission to listen in. Bill Stern, a renowned broadcaster, yelled as the Huskies marched onto the Rose Bowl field, "You can tell that these young people are from the Northwest, where men behave like men. See those muscles?" But the undermanned Husky team lost 29-0 to the Trojans because they were simply too talented. The Washington Huskies were keen to regain their former glory under their suave and dynamic coach Howie Odell after going a number of years without playing in the Rose Bowl. Hugh McElhinney's successful recruitment garnered front-page coverage across the Northwest. Superpowers like UCLA, Alabama, Notre Dame, Arizona State, Nebraska, and California had all expressed interest in McElhinney. Seattle residents felt quite energized after this move. Big and strong, McElhinney was gifted with breakaway speed and the extraordinary capacity to pivot on a dime. Don Heinrich, a talented quarterback from Bremerton, was already on the roster. McElhinney and Heinrich together were dubbed the King in the Arm or the Ideal Backfield. A fever pitch of Rose Bowl aspirations was achieved by Husky supporters. However, due to injuries, the pair would only play one complete season together. 1950 served as the season to beat all other seasons. It all started with the historic opening of a brand new upper deck for Husky Stadium Southside that cost $1,175,000. McElhinney carried 16 times for 177 yards and a 91-yard touchdown run as Washington defeated Kansas State 33-7. While completing 15 of 21 pass attempts, Heinrich threw for 292 yards and 4 touchdowns. Washington accumulated victories and great stats as the season went on. Against Washington State, McElhinney set a school record for rushing yards with 296 and concluded the season with 1,107. Heinrich was selected as an All-American and led the country in passing that season. The campaign came to a conclusion with a huge sense of what if. The Rose Bowl spot for both teams was on the line when Washington played the California Golden Bears in November at Husky Stadium. Late in the fourth quarter, UW was down 14-7 and had possession of the ball on their own 9-yard line. A drive that reached the Bears' 2-yard line was led by Heinrich and McElhinney. Husky supporters who observed what happened next more than 50 years ago are still troubled by it. Heinrich decided to try a pass on fourth down. He stumbled after being struck, but Cal recovered. To the Rose Bowl went the Bears. Washington finished the season with an 8-2 record. It would be Washington's final celebration for a further decade. The Huskies endured several subpar seasons after being placed on probation in 1955 due to an uncovered slush fund. Following a dismal season, the 1959 Huskies were not widely known. The Huskies, under the direction of third-year coach Jim Owens, endured taxing sessions meant to pick out the less dedicated players and crank up the toughness. Washington dominated its opponents early in the season, dropping just a single game to USC. In front of a packed house at Husky Stadium, the Huskies defeated Washington State 20-0 in the regular season finale to secure a spot on the Rose Bowl. Owens received the key to the city and had the notoriety of a rock star. Bob Schlorett, a quarterback with just one eye, and Don Maketa, a running back, were also heroes. Washington found itself playing Wisconsin of the prestigious Big Ten Conference in Pasadena as a significant underdog. The Rose Bowl had long been dominated by the Big Ten. Even though the Huskies produced a good story, most thought they were in over their heads. Fans of the Huskies weren't concerned, however. They traveled to Southern California in caravans, 40,000 of them dressed in purple and gold. Washington dominated the Badgers from the first kick of the game, throttling Wisconsin 44-8 to conclude the season with an impressive 10-1 record. After a string of triumphs in 1960, Washington managed to get back to Pasadena. They competed against the top-ranked Minnesota Gophers this time. Washington won 17-7 to earn yet another 10-1 record. The squad eventually got together in Seattle in order to be officially acknowledged as the national champions by the University of Washington. In 1963, the Huskies competed in the Rose Bowl once more but fell to Illinois this time around. According to Los Angeles Times columnist Jim Murray, "I won't say Owens gets the hungriest football players in the West each year, but if they were in the Roman Coliseum, the Lions wouldn't come out." Interest in Washington football was waning as quarterback Sonny Sixkiller prepared for his first start of his career against Michigan State in 1970. After a few years of racial tension and misunderstanding, civil rights leaders demanded Jim Owens' resignation from the program. The Huskies struggled to a 1-9 record in 1969 as campus protests against the Vietnam War erupted. Seattle was also going through a depressing recession that was driven by Boeing's extensive layoffs. Everything was altered by Six Killer on the 19th of September 1970. Seattle was energized by the UW's 42-16 upset victory over Michigan State. Six Killer passed the ball with a Showtime passing motion, whizzing it all over the field. Everyone was drawn to his warm personality, and Sports Illustrated decided to feature him on their cover. The Ballad of Sonny Six Killer song was also written in his honor. He was actively sought after by Native American organizations to represent their interests. Owens and Six Killer were never able to advance to the postseason together since the Pac-8 Conference only ever allowed its champion to attend a bowl game. UW did, however, produce records of 6-4, 8-3, and 8-3 again while giving a region that needed it some hope. Washington's 1977 season got off to a 1-3 start, and Husky supporters were upset with their struggling football team. Don James, a third-year coach, had a 12-14 record despite claims that his players disliked him. On the 8th of October, a catalyst occurred in the opposing team's locker area at Eugene, Oregon's Autzen Stadium. Dave Terrell, a UW booster, was positioned behind a cordoned-off area when the Huskies emerged from the tunnel. He remarked, "I hadn't seen us look so intense in ages. I warned another booster that this match had all the ingredients for a slaughter." That day, Washington thrashed Oregon 54-0, ushering in a new era. The Huskies won their remaining games, shocking the much-favored Michigan in the Rose Bowl in 1978. At the goal line, UW linebacker Michael Jackson made a game-changing play by intercepting a Michigan throw for a touchdown. The game's MVP was Warren Moon, who overcame obstacles to become Washington's first black quarterback. Don James and the Washington Huskies gained national attention after that. They were renowned for their strict play, powerful hitting, and fierce defense. The 1979 team defeated Texas in the Sun Bowl and finished the season with a 10-2 record. The 1981 team, which beat Iowa 28-0, joined the 1980 team in competing in the Rose Bowl. Washington finished the 1984 season 11-1 and ranked number 2 in the nation after defeating Brian Bosworth and Oklahoma in the Orange Bowl. Sports Illustrated named the top 3 college football coaches in that same year. Number 1, Don James. Number 2, Don James. And number 3, Don James. A supporter handed Don James a message in December of 1991 as the unbeaten Huskies got ready to play Michigan in the Rose Bowl. Having just observed the 50th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, President George H.W. Bush sent it. It said, "Dear Coach of the Year Don, yesterday after returning from Pearl Harbor, I turned on the TV and saw the wonderful news. Congratulations on receiving such a meritorious honor. Best wishes from me to you. I hope to run into you soon again. I wish you and your motivated group of people luck. Bush, George H.W." Washington thrashed Michigan 34-14 in front of 103,566 spectators and millions of TV viewers. The CNN USA Today coaches poll crowned the Huskies as national champions. Since Gil Dobie's team in 1916, Washington had not had an unbeaten team. Future first-round picks in the NFL draft such as Steve Emptman, Napoleon Kaufman, Lincoln Kennedy, and Dana Hall were on the team. 5 days after Washington defeated Stanford to earn its 22nd consecutive victory, on the 5th of November 1992, a Seattle Times headline sent shockwaves throughout the nation. Huskies' Hobert got $5,000 loan, it announced. The account described how Charles Rice, an Idaho scientist, loaned money to Billy Joe Hobert, the standout quarterback for the UW. After a month, the Los Angeles Times started its own run of pieces criticizing the Washington football program's ethics. America was gripped by wild rumors about whether Washington had an illegal football program under Don James. Washington was placed on a 2-year bowl probation by the Pac-10 Conference on the 22nd of August 1993, following a 6-month inquiry. Also, they took away 20 scholarships from the Huskies and $1.4 million in television money. It was the harshest penalty in conference history to that point. 24 charges involving Hobert, Husky boosters, and falsified expense reports submitted by student hosts were covered in the Pac-10 study. There was no evidence that the University of Washington went out to acquire a competitive advantage, the Pac-10 further claimed. The examination revealed that Charles Rice had no affiliation with the University of Washington and was not a booster. Although the Pac-10 acknowledged that Rice's loan was improper because it was based on Hobert's anticipated NFL earnings, it said it was inconclusive as to whether Husky coaches ought to have been aware of its existence. A sponsor in Southern California was named by the Pac-10 for paying Husky players for little to no labor during a summer jobs program. James immediately quit in protest after hearing he was going on probation. The world of college football was shook by this revelation. Art Thiel of the Seattle PI criticized the Pac-10, but added that James' resignation was an act of cowardice that he would not tolerate in any of his players or staff. James' opponent and former Washington State coach Jim Walden offered his opinion. "The conference going against the law is almost like police brutality," he said. Don James, who is one of the most well-respected people in our field, was given the death penalty. James later claimed that he and the team had been abandoned by the UW, leaving them at the whim of the league. "After all the money these athletes have earned for them," James declared in 2004, "I said that if this university isn't going to support us any better than that, then I'm not going to work here anymore. It appeared like they were out to harm us because we were so good, rather than help us get through this." William Gerberding, a former UW president, claimed in 2007 that he had defended James and the squad. "Small-minded individuals took advantage of the situation to criticize our coach, our team, and our university. It was, and is still, a painful situation." James has the most victories in Washington history with 153. The College Football Hall of Fame has inducted him. Jim Lambright had a difficult task ahead of him when he took over a team that was on probation. For 30 years, Lambright, sometimes referred to as Lambo by his teammates and friends, had a connection to Husky football as a player, assistant coach, and now head coach. He won 44 games over the course of the following 6 years, but he never really appeared to shake the expectations that followed the Don James era. Lambright's Whammy in Miami incident from 1994 will live on forever. In the Orange Bowl, the Huskies defeated the Miami Hurricanes 38-20. Miami's NCAA record 58-game home winning streak was broken with the victory. Lambright was enthusiastically carried off the field by Husky players after being hoisted over their shoulders. After Air Force dominated the Huskies in the Oahu Bowl, Lambright would be let go in December of 1998. This is a history podcast, after all, so I felt it was necessary to not get into the Huskies of the 21st century. I tend to try and keep these episodes mostly grounded in the past and before 2000. If you want to learn more about the modern UW football program, there are several great videos over on YouTube. I didn't forget about you Wazoo folks out there, I promise. In fact, episode 113, which we'll be releasing on the 20th of September, will be all about the history of Washington State University in general. I have a rough draft going of the history of their football program, but it will not be released until the end of summer 2024 to coincide with the start of the 2024 college football season, much like this episode is for the 2023 season. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star review and don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss a new episode. Doing so really helps the show to grow and to expand to a new audience, so any help that you can give in that regard will be greatly appreciated. Sources for this episode include The Glory of Washington, The People and Events That Shaped the Husky Athletic Tradition by Jim Daves, W. Thomas Porter, and Thomas Porter, Husky Stadium Great Games and Golden Moments by Jim Daves and W. Thomas Porter, Go Huskies, Celebrating the Washington Football Tradition by W. Thomas Porter, Bow Down to Washington, A Story of Husky Football by Dick Rockney, 100 Years of Husky Football by Steve Rudman and Karen Chave, The Seattle Times, SportsReference.com, HistoryLink.org, Husky Football in the Don James Era by Derek Johnson, and the University of Washington Athletics website. Thank you for listening to episode 110, An Early History of Husky Football. Episode 111 will be released next week. A special thank you goes out to Al Hirsch for providing the music for the podcast. If you have any questions about the show, please contact historyoftheevergreenstatepod@gmail.com. Thank you once again for listening to another episode of the History of the Evergreen State podcast. And until next time, I'm your host, John C.
There's peace on the Skokomish, on the Queets and on the Hull. There's calm on the Nisqually, born of ageless ice and snow. A land that nature loves so much, she stays the whole year round. I trade a royal palace for a shack on Puget Sound. There's Chimicum and Stillicum, where spouts the gooey duck, the singing Stillaguamish and the swirling Skookum Chuck, and Moclips and Copalis, where the razor clams abound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound.